my calculations are correct, when this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious shit.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
It's showtime.
Right, welcome everybody to another episode of the VHS Strikes Back. I am one of your hosts, Chris, and my co-host, a very good friend, is Dave.
Hey there, Chris, and hello to our listeners out there. Welcome to the VHS Strikes Back, the show where we dust off the old video player and go on a nostalgic journey to look at the good and the bad movies of yesteryear. Now, Chris, what are we going to review this week?
Well, Dave, we have a special guest, one of our great friends and Comics in Motion creators and the host of Genuine Chit Chat podcast, Mr. Mike Burton. So Mike, I think you should introduce this week's episode because this is your Patreon pick, my friend.
Well, hello there. Thank you so much for having me, and hello to all the wonderful VHS listeners out there. I don't know if you've thought of what you're going to call the listeners of the VHS Strikes Back. I thought strikers or something, but I don't know if that's too football-y. I don't know.
Streakers.
Streakers, maybe. I mean, with Chris's history, and there's many anecdotes, maybe that's just Chris is the streaker and the rest of us are the strikers. But we are tackling the 1996 movie directed by Danny Boyle, starring Ewan McGregor, and this is Trainspotting. Which I won't say exactly my thoughts on this. I'm going to try and do what Dave does in the show and keep my cards close to my chest, which if anyone's listened to any podcast I've ever done, I'm really bad at that. I normally blow my load immediately, premature celebration. That's my problem on podcasts. So, you know, I'm going to try and keep it close, but I'll say this is a very important film, I'd say, for the Britain, I'd say, and definitely for Ewan McGregor's career and everyone involved in this. But it's an interesting film. I don't know what each of your respective histories are with this film, if you'd both seen it before, but I'm very interested. Selfishly, I just want to hear what you guys think about this and push my way to the front. I was like, I want to hear, and I'll come on if you want me to. And you very kindly let me on the show. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you, Mark. So you say, Dave.
That's how a professional does it.
yeah, and then you got us two pair of ballads. I'm thinking the name should be for our listeners, The Cults of Shoulder.
Terrible.
Maybe not. Right. Anyway, carry on. So, Dave, when did you first watch Trainspotting? I think that's fucking crazy. The Cults of Shoulder.
So, anyway, I'm going to make a weird parallel, right? So, I mentioned about Pulp Fiction when we did that one, that 94 as at university or college, and it was one of those where everyone's got, you know, one of the various posters for Pulp Fiction up in their student dorms and whatever. You go around to any student house. In 96, it was the same for Trainspotting. Just everyone had these various posters, and they really pushed the marketing as well. So if you were walking around town or whatever, you'd see it on the big billboards and whatever. So they really, really pushed it. And when it came out, I just don't think I'd seen anything like this at all. And I'll be honest, I don't even think I liked it. You know, when I watched it the first time, I mean, it's quite funny when you watch it multiple times. But that first time, having never seen anything like this before, it was quite shocking. And then obviously not quite the first half, but at least the first half hour or so, you know, there are genuinely funny bits in it. But, you know, there's something that happens in the middle, isn't it? And it's like, fucking hell, you know, this is really quite dire. And it's one of those that sits with you for ages and you walk away out of that movie theater with that scar of, and it sits with you. You're thinking about it and thinking about it. So, but when I haven't watched this again for years, and I have to say, when I came to rewatch it this time, I realized I must have watched this quite a lot, because every scene, you know, when one scene finishes, I know what happens. I think the only bit that I'd kind of forgot was a little bit about Tommy. And that's kind of how he departs.
Exactly what Megan said. Megan's right. Only seen it once before. I showed her a couple years back, and she was like, I could remember bits of it. And then every scene, she's like, oh, it's this bit. Oh, it's this bit. And the only parts she forgot was the stuff about Tommy, which I'm sure we'll delve into as well, because there's a lot to say there.
Yeah. But, I mean, how about yourself, Chris?
Well, I've got a story, Mike. So, you know, you won't be here if I didn't have a story.
My
so,
shoulders are ready. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, no, I've got one later on about the shoulder, actually.
Oh,
I've been thinking about this. So, anyway, So when this came out, I'm with Dave, like, you know, 96, I was 17. So, this is I think obviously it would have come out on VHS probably 97 at some point. It was never out straight away then. It was always like a year usually or 9 months or something turnaround. David probably known well from Blockbuster, but it was usually around that time. And then it was always like hot potatoes, you know, to sort of rent it. And then it would go on VHS. So I didn't actually watch it when it first came out. I think I watched it sort of around the back end of 97, but I knew the VHS cover, you could never rent it in like Blockbuster or anywhere. It was so iconic and such an important movie. As a teenager then, like 17 going 18, it was one of the movies. I was going out to Manchester. I may have been trying to keep myself awake when I was going into Manchester because I was like training a lot and stuff. That's all I'll say. So, you know, the drug side of it was like, yeah, I understood. And it was so gruesome. But I remember, I think I mentioned this before, Mr. Smith, who didn't live next door at 70, we lived at 76 Greatstone Road, at 74, he wasn't there, and it wasn't Mr. Smith, but Mr. Smith then decided to buy a load of free videos.
Britannia,
basically. Mr. Smith, allegedly. And they went next door, and obviously, because the postman knew us, he would then come to our door and go, oh, I've had these delivered. And one of them was Trainspotting. And I'd had a heavy night in Manchester, and it was rough as hell. And I had a cold in that, but I'd gone out and probably walked home from Manchester, which was about 2 to 3 miles from my house, but I had that much energy. And I'll say no more, that we used to all walk home. So, and then because one of my mates was a tight ass, he wouldn't pay for a fucking taxi and pay a pound. So we used to end up walking home like dickheads. But anyway, we was in bed watching it. It was me and my two brothers, and they were both ill. And I was rough as well, but it was more self-induced. And this videos just appeared in a couple of CDs. And I thought, oh, Mr. Smith, let's put this on. So I put it on in my bedroom. And my dad, who, well, not only is he a raging bellend, but also he's not very good at like looking after or like, you know, comes, he says, do you want some Weetabix? So I went, yeah. So he went downstairs and made Weetabix. Now, I never have cereal with sugar on or anything. I never have tea with sugar on anything. He brings up this fucking Weetabix for me and my brothers that was, I'd been there for about 3 days, and I only like Weetabix when it's hard, you know, and you've got to like crunch into it. So when it's gone, even though I love porridge, it's gone a bit porridgey. It's not for me. And I'm not even bullshitting here when I say this, but you know exactly what scene that was on when I was eating Weetabix with sugar, don't you? And I've never ate Weetabix with sugar since, because I had 3 mouthfuls, got in bed, and I think I went straight to the toilet and threw up. So that was, and that is on my life. That is the first time I'd ever watched Trainspotting, and I was only 17 then. I couldn't have done it, but I literally wanted to throw the Weetabix at me. Dad was like, don't ever fucking bring that up to me again. You know, like, it was awful. Me and my two brothers were like, what the fuck? And they were younger than me. Adam's a year younger. Nathan's a year younger than him. So they would have been 16 and 15, but we were all just ill in bed. And it was one of them experiences that has stuck with me forever with Trainspotting. As soon as I see that VHS cover, I think of Weetabix with sugar on and how fucking minging it was as he climbed out the toilet. Well, there you go.
Well, my experience, funnily enough, with Dave mentioning the posters, I mean, I'm a little bit younger than you guys. Sorry to point that out. So I was far too young to comprehend what a film even was when this film came out, because I am a 90s baby. But I had the Choose Life poster up in my bedroom for years. I think I was probably the last person in Britain to do it. I think I was probably the last person to buy the Choose Life, you know, the Choose Life, Choose a Fucking Great Television, the whole spiel. And I thought, this is the coolest thing in the world. And I stand by, I think it's poster-wise, it's the aesthetic is amazing. But I got that when I was 16, I think, 16, 17-ish, when I started having a little bit of my own money. So it'd always be weekend trips to HMV, look through the whole poster rack. You know, normally you'd catch a couple of the saucier posters that you wouldn't find in HMV nowadays. You go, oh, that's a nice one. I'll just look at for a little bit longer and then turn it. No, I'm just looking at movie posters. Definitely not anything else. Definitely not. But so I got the Choose Life poster because I heard about the film, and one of my connections to some of the films that you guys have seen and things like that is I have two older brothers, one who's 17 years older than me, one is 20 years older than me, because my family history is a big mess. I'm not going to go into it all here, but different mum, same dad. And so they'd show me lots of really cool different films, you know, Predator, Aliens, that kind of stuff. When I was a bit young, my parents said, you can show Mike whatever you want as long as there's no hard drugs or sex in it. So I couldn't watch like My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend with Uma Thurman, but I could watch Aliens, Predator, Terminator and things like that. Really bizarre way my parents thought in that way. But when I got to 16-ish, they just kind of let me watch anything. It was almost like 2 years before my age, I could watch the sort of the certificate above. And I remember in school, I went to quite a rough school, to be honest with you. And for religious studies, they never did really religious stuff. They would just do like moral questions, things like that. And then drugs came up. And we went into a whole module about drugs and things, and I didn't know anything about it. And I just found it quite interesting. I watched those Talk to Frank adverts, which a lot of them are a lot of nonsense. But I was like, oh, this is quite interesting, this whole world of things I'd never heard of. And so I remember my religious studies teacher saying, oh, yeah, we're talking about drugs and addiction stuff. And he's like, oh, yeah, that scene from Trainspotting is really horrendous. Now going back, I'm like, you're telling a bunch of 15, 16-year-olds about Trainspotting. Much too old for them. But I remember him saying that, and I was like, what is it? And then I heard about Ewan McGregor, and I loved Ewan McGregor from your Star Wars, Attack of the Clones and things. And I was like, what is this film? You know, so I went in to watch it. Obviously, very different film, very different portrayal to Obi-Wan to Mark Renton. But I remember watching the film. Along the time, I was also reading Nikki Sixx's Heroin Diaries book, his biography, which is one of my favorite books of all time. And both of those really changed my perception on what drug addiction was, these really, Megan hates this term because her surname, gritty look at things. And this film is British social realism. It's like This Is England is a similar kind of vibe, and there's a film called Sweet 16, and lots of those kind of almost people films in air quotes, but no gloss to them, no sheen. It's really hard-hitting stuff, and they're the kind of films that really speak to me in a lot of ways. Films that kind of have a lot to say, but a lot of subtext and just very well written and things. And I just think, off what Dave said before, this film was unlike anything I'd ever seen. And it took me I watched it once, I was like, what is this? And then I watched it very shortly after, within a few months, and be like, okay, now the shock has gone away. Let's actually watch this properly to see what it's all about. And to this day, I've seen films in similar veins, like This Is England, but even films like The Basketball Diaries with DiCaprio, all about young heroin users, nothing hits like this film does. And so it's just I came into it very late, but I had the poster and everything when I was 16 and edgy.
Oh, that's really good.
I what I'd say as well is just to shine a light on what it was like at the time, you know, when you're a sort of young adult and stuff. But the music was such a big factor with this film as well. So, you know, you'd go to a nightclub or whatever, you know, Born Slippy had come on, you'd be throwing some shapes and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, everyone, you know, who'd been hanging around the outsides and stuff, everyone would just get onto the dance floor. And like, it was just a massive, massive part of it. Iggy Pop, you know, suddenly got massive again. And so, yeah, the music was really a big part of this popularity as well.
It was.
It's so iconic. And music in itself, I think Tony's mentioned it before, and I know, you know, if people don't know me, I have a Star Wars podcast, I do it with Dave, I'm sure I'll go into that waffle towards the end, but Star Wars, what Tony always says, good old Tony Farina, he says that with Star Wars, John Williams is the big star of Star Wars, because the main thing that makes it iconic is the music. Indiana Jones, E.T., Superman, and John Williams have been involved with all of these. Music is such a major part. Pulp Fiction, the soundtrack's most, like, is so iconic, you know, and you've got this film, also an incredibly iconic soundtrack. You know, there's so many, every scene has got its own thing attached, like Perfect Day by Lou Reed. That has got such an important part of this film. So it's like, and whenever I hear Born Slippy, which occasionally comes on the radio, I mean, I've never been to a rave and heard Born Slippy, but whenever I hear it, I see the scenes in Trainspotting and I'm thinking Choose Life. And I just think music is such, especially with a lot of the films you guys tackle, you know, 80s, 90s, music is, if you've got a good soundtrack, it can make an okay film good, but it can make a great film like legendary. And that's another thing about this film that really, the Choose Life and the music, just sort of Pulp Fiction, you know, you've got these similarities which make these films last, especially in kind of the 90s and 80s as well.
It's true that, because I think, like you were talking about the music, Dave, you think at the time, like Oasis were at the height of the powers, you had Labour in government, they were all going to 10 Downing Street. It was like this film come out, it almost like...
Just to be clear, Labour was 97. I know you watched it in 97, but this came out in 96.
All right, then. Anyway, but you know what I mean? There was a big movement where that the music dictated us as like teenagers or late teenagers, you know, our life. And you had shows like TFI Friday with Chris Evans. You'd have like all the big bands like Ocean Colour Scene, Oasis. Everyone wanted to be on this show on a Friday night and all that. And you don't realise it's like this sort of thing with Ewan McGregor. And obviously, I know we went to Obi-Wan and that. There was just loads of little iconic things I can sort of look back and go, actually, there was a time where there was an era that was really good. But when you're living in something, you don't. And this was like, this was almost like the poster child of the movie, especially in the British one, that sort of took the whole country and probably the world by storm. And that's where Ewan McGregor got his stock from, you know, because I was saying to Dave, I went down the rabbit hole. There's a show. Have you ever seen Lipstick on Your Collar with Ewan McGregor, Mike? So it was a 1993 Channel 4 show, Dennis Potter, and it's a musical like show. So it's based after World War II, and he's like some Russian translator for the British Army, but he's bored, and all he keeps doing is imagining these little like musicals come on, and there's this absolutely, these proper stories, but it's an absolutely stunning blonde girl who I was fucking, that was going to be my shoulder story, but fuck me, did I fucking go for it with her. She's beautiful in that show. But that's where I knew Ewan McGregor from. So when this came out, obviously before Star Wars, Phantom Menace, I was like, that's not the same guy. Not really any internet. When it was, you know, it was like, I had that on VHS and I remember putting it on going, oh, that's the same guy. But he's got like black slick back hair and stuff. So you're not as slim as he was as Renton because he lost weight for the part. But I was aware of him and he stood out in that because he was pretty much the star of it. He started off as like a co-star, but as the show went on, the 8 episodes, whatever it is, you can see he becomes like the main character and he just had something about him. So I've always like, in different things he's been in, I've always respected him. He's a really, really good actor. So yeah, he was. But Lipstick on Your Collar, you and Megan would love that, Mike. Channel 4 classic show. Yeah, yeah. And thank me later because you'll realise straight away and go, no wonder Chris watched this because there was plenty of Aldi toilet roll being used when I watched that one. I'm telling you, oh, what a show.
We've got a real spectrum of where we all were introduced to Ewan McGregor because I saw him first in a film called Shallow Grave.
I was going to mention that, and that's another Danny. That was Danny Boyle's debut, I believe. Yeah, I watched that after the fact. I watched this, and I was like, I need to watch everything Danny Boyle and Ewan McGregor have ever done, which I still haven't because there's so much.
There is a lot. It's your very own back to the filmography. But that was quite big when I was at uni as well, to be fair. So, you know, I already sort of knew who he was, but that still didn't prepare me for the movie.
No, I don't think anything does, Dave. And Danny Boyle's from around here near me, Bury. That's where he was, Danny Boyle. But yeah, I think is Shallow Grave the one with John Sims out of Life on Mars? Because I love Life on Mars. No, is that not
Shallow Grave? Christopher Eccleston.
That's, oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
It's the three of them.
Yeah. Sorry. I knew it was one of them. Because I remember Christopher Eccleston was in Our Friends in the North with Daniel Craig as well. I remember watching that one years ago. Old school BBC. But anyway, shall we get into this trailer?
Let's go.
Choose life, choose a job. Choose a career. Choose a family. Choose a big television.
You're a quiet, sensitive type. A little bit crazy, a little bit bad.
Choose washing machines, cars, compact displays, and dental insurance.
You lied on your application.
Only to get my foot in the door.
What exactly attracts you to the leisure industry?
In a word, pleasure. Like, my pleasure and other people's leisure.
He's always been lacking in moral fibre.
He knows a lot about Sean Connery.
That's hardly a substitute.
Do you see the beast? Have you got it in your sights?
Clear enough, Mitch Moneypenny.
Choose sitting on that couch watching mind-numbing, spirit-crushing game shows, stuffing junk food into your mouth.
The man is a psycho, man. He's a mate. So what can you do?
What are you two talking about?
Football! What are you talking about?
Shopping!
What's on the menu this evening, sir?
The dodgiest scam in a lifetime of dodgy scams. Leisure wear and matching luggage. Choose good health and a career. Choose your friends. Choose your future. Choose life.
Mark Renton is a 26-year-old unemployed heroin addict living with his parents in Edinburgh. Renton regularly takes drugs with his friends, Sick Boy, Spud, Mother Superior, their dealer. Renton's other friends, aggressive, alcoholic, psychopath Begbie, and honest footballer and recreational speed user Tommy, who both abstain from heroin use and warn him about his dangerous drug habit. Now, Chris, what do you reckon to the opening of this movie?
I think the music, Iggy, as we said before, the trailer, Iggy Pop, the intro, them running, being chased, and like obviously when Renton hits the car, you know, this year, and he goes over and he's laughing and that. It's just so iconic. Like, absolutely, you know full well, like you said, Dave, about Iggy Pop, just was completely, he just ascended after this. Then he was massive because of this movie. It just absolutely revitalized his career. And as soon as I hear that song, I just think straight away Trainspotting. So I think it's absolutely iconic. And I think I've watched it maybe 3 or 4 times in my lifetime. But yeah, every time I watch it, it feels familiar. And I just think they get the tone of like Scotland, living in like on a council flats, living, you know, like this drug thing. It's not glamorized like you see in some of the movies. It's real dingy and dirty world these people live in, because they've got nothing. It's all about the next hit and that. So yeah, it starts strong, and the characters just feel bizarre and also quite familiar as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I'd say with Iggy Pop, fun little fact about me. I know that a friend of the show and a friend of ours who was on Comics Emotion 1000 and stuff, Max Byrne, he and I were both at Sonosphere at the same time, a music festival that was a European one that's not in the UK anymore. And in 2010, which was the first festival I think I ever went to in my life, first proper music gig I went to that wasn't a local band, Sonosphere, Alice Cooper was the first live act I ever saw in my life, which is incredible. But Iggy Pop was there as well, Iggy and the Stooges. And I only loosely knew who he was, but this was in 2010. He was still going nuts. I think he's almost always just looked really old, but it's just, he kind of got to this age of like looking anywhere between the age of late 40s and 70. And in the last sort of 30 years, he's never looked any different. And he's just getting older and older. And I remember seeing him and I was like, I know him from somewhere. And I think it's because Trainspotting and that kind of jazz. But yeah, the music's amazing. The start of this, I've got one of my notes is lots of lists. But I think myself and Jack of Back to the Filmography, we're kindred spirits in the way that I like to watch, you know, whole filmographies of things. But also, I really like lists. I've got lists everywhere of just like things for podcasting, for anything I do. If it's more than two things, I'll write a list. And in this film, I've really noticed that a lot of the dialogue, especially at the start, is essentially listing stuff, but in a very clever, fun way, you know. And it's just the way the film kind of kicks in. Straight away, you've got running, you've got kind of people, it's like, these aren't good people, there's lots of swearing, but it doesn't feel overly gratuitous, even though it's like every other word is fuck, basically. And they drop the C-bomb loads and all that stuff, and I'm no prude of language, but it feels like, this just feels so real. You know, you watch a lot of films where there's either gratuitous swearing or that there's people who talk in certain ways, and especially in American films, it seems like it's got a glossy sheen to it. There's none of that here. There's all stripped away. And I think you just connect immediately, because as kind of Chris said, the characters, although they are extreme versions and almost caricatures in some way, especially someone like Begbie, each character has resembling features of people you've known at some point in your life to some degree. And I think that although they're more caricatures of themselves, just immediately you feel in the world. It doesn't feel like you have to invest in the world. It just feels like you're watching these people live. And I think they're the best kind of people films for me. And that, again, mixed with the music, it just makes everything about this, the pacing and everything, you're just bought in straight away. So the way it kicks off is just, again, and it's also one of those things a film which does, which I quite like, which is it has a scene from like the middle of the film. And then it kind of is like, how did they get here without so much as saying it? Which I it's a cheesy trope, but I really enjoy it.
I think it's, yeah, I guess it's cheesy. I mean, it's almost Pulp Fiction-like, isn't it? Non-linear, but I like the way they did that. And there's something endearing where Ewan McGregor just gives that massive shit-eating grin. You know, he's just just been run over, basically, and he's sort of shocked. And then he's just, like, smiling away like the Joker or something. But I think the high energy way that this movie starts is amazing. Like you say, one of the bits I guess I'd forgotten is just bang, you're straight in. There's no kind of context building or anything. It's just, woof, you know, and you've got the music and everything. It is just so, so iconic. But what I was thinking back to, so we obviously laugh about going, you know, growing up in the 80s and stuff, but watching this movie's reminded me a little bit, growing up in sort of Thatcher's Britain, you had loads of these public information drug adverts and stuff. And the schools are really ramming home the message about drug use and stuff in a real kind of when I look back and think back about it now, in a real kind of right wing way, you know, just it's terrible. And so you were just peppered with that message about how horrendous it was. And if you were to ever take any of this, it would be your life, your family, everything destroyed. There was no real information about, well, why do people do this? And so this was my first exposure to it. And like I say, it was one of those things that just shaped my whole belief system, you know, because you've grown up with this messaging. And you know what? For the first half hour, yeah, they're obviously living in a shit environment. And that's kind of their coping mechanism to it. And it's pretty funny. And they're doing it because they're escaping from their actual situation. It's not like they're just living in high society and having a great time and then shooting up some opium. You know, they are just in a shit situation. And, you know, the best thing about their life is that next score.
Mm. And it's that thing of showing it over and over, like he tries to quit and he comes back and there's reasoning why. It's the addict's mindset of it all. But as someone who, you know, in my youth, I had a certain perception of drugs, and then I've been open about this on my podcast and things, but like when my dad passed away back, you know, when I was 19, I didn't cope with it in the best way. I wasn't necessarily self-destructive, but I think Chris and I, our youths may be riddled with substances that aren't just alcohol, if we put it that way. Not saying I never did heroin, to clarify, but you know, yeah. There were certain parts. And I remember that when, with the whole, because I grew up as well with the Talk to Frank adverts, things like that, when you hear, oh my God, you smoke cannabis once and you have a paranoid, you know, panic attack, then you become lazy and all this stuff. And then if one was to do it, and then you go, this is literally nothing at all like I've been told. And that's when I think with the idea of the gateway drug, which is a theory that I don't subscribe to. I think the problem is when you tell someone you do any of these things ever and you'll die and you'll be addicted forever. And then if you know someone who's done it, an older family member, an older friend, and they go, it's literally nothing like that. And then you try it and then you go, this is fine. This is actually probably less intense than alcohol is. And then you start going down. I think that often when you're like a teenager or young adult, you kind of maybe go down a rabbit hole or something. And the problem is when the government is telling you, you do all this, it's bad. You go, well, if this thing isn't that bad, maybe this thing isn't either. And this thing isn't. And I feel like if the public health service and the government was a bit more honest about the real, you know, there are definitely issues with drugs and all that stuff. Don't get me wrong. But if they were more honest rather than conflating things, I think that the amount of individuals who would try it would probably be less. Because I just think it's that thing. You tell everyone to abstain. What does everyone want to do? The exact thing you're telling them not to do. And I think that's a part of it as well. And I think the culture of it, especially in this film, is constantly, you do heroin, all you get from everyone who doesn't do heroin is telling you to stop doing heroin. You know, there's that scene with Begbie where it's like, I wouldn't put that shite in my veins. And he's drinking alcohol and smoking a cigarette. Yeah. And it's that very clever thing where it's like, to be honest, drugs are drugs. Alcohol's a drug. Cigarettes are a drug. It's just which ones do the government decide are legal or not? And that's a whole big conversation. I could do hours talking about the war on drugs and all that jazz. But it's just, again, a lot of what this film does very cleverly is it's like, no, don't shy away. Heroin addiction is a serious problem and your life will probably turn to shit if you get full-on addicted to this. But recreational drug users can often be fairly functioning in certain respects. And it's this weird thing, because it's not actually saying that drugs are good or bad. It's just, here's a group of people and here's how certain drugs affected their life. And that's one of Irvin Welsh's real specialities. He's done the book Acid House, which is also a film which I've seen. There's a film called Ecstasy that's not that great. That's another one. And there's a film called Filth with James McAvoy, and that's all about cocaine. And that's also written by Irvin Welsh. And that's a really interesting look as well. So Irvin Welsh, a lot of his writing is actually to do with how different drugs affect different people in certain environments. And it's just drugs and religion are two elements of life that I've just been intrigued by. The documentaries I've watched, things like that. It's just a really interesting thing because we're fed so much misinformation basically for so long.
Yeah, I like you say, I could speak as well for hours on this topic. And also, you know, I was at college, you know, it's not as if I gravitate to alcohol now, but just because I know where it's safe. But one of the most iconic scenes, of course, you get the run in as well. And then you're straight into his kind of into Brenton's mindset, aren't you, where he's trying to give up. But he just needs that one last score, so he goes in. I don't really understand why he had to put the drugs up his arse. I don't, because he gets them out later. But you know, I love that scene and the way it's shot, because it's panned away and then he's just kind of walking along. And McGregor's kind of physical comedy, to be honest, yeah. You know, I am no longer constipated. He just sort of doubles over. And he legs it, and of course you get the worst toilet in Scotland, don't you? And you're like, oh my God. And I think this is one of the things that when you watch it for the first time, it knocks you sick. And obviously, Chris, you've told about your experience with the Weetabix there, but it is real heaving stuff. And so I don't think I could enjoy the funniness of it, if funniness is a word. But watching it this time, I was crying. And the fact that you get all of the sound effects and everything, you know, as he's on the toilet, but then that panic in his face, oh shit, he shat out his drugs and then he has to go back. And I was looking up, apparently, you know, the whole toilet was, the special effects, if you like, were done with chocolate. And so it actually smelt quite nice, even though it looks absolutely rank. So, I mean, utterly iconic. And like I say, I watched it this time and I was just crying, laughing. But yeah, I remember the first time in the cinema, just like heaving at that point.
Yeah, I think I was fucking heaving watching this yesterday. And there's even a bit where, obviously, like you say, it's chocolate. He's got like shit on his fingers. And I'm like, you know, and he's digging it out. And I was going, hup. And I'm not really the sort of person to heave. Because like, when, you know, when you have Jordan was a baby, if she was going to be sick, Sam would run out the room. I could always tell. I'd just pick her up and let her be sick on me. I'd like, so it'd go all over the carpet. Before I'd just pick my shirt up and go on. And I'd have her in my arms. And she, you know, and stuff like that never bothers me, you know. But watching it on screen, I don't know, real life, I'm fine. But watch it on screen. It's like, fucking, you know, I've got cat. Well, I'd be lost the cat, but like the dog and that. If there's some sort of finger, well, you know, full well, it's me who's got to go and clean it up. Recently with the cat, before we put the cat down, it was doing it all over the fucking house. And Jordan's pissing himself, ringing me, going, Dad, you need to come back. I'm thinking someone's broken the house. Got to know, fucking cat shit in my bedroom. It's fucking minging. But anyway, I'm the one who's got to go in and, you know, do it all and pick it up. But so it doesn't bother me. But this scene gets me, the effect of it, even now after, what is it? It's 28 years later. It still absolutely makes me heave. But also, we've all been there. And I think what's relatable, it doesn't matter who you are, man, woman, whatever, there has been times in your life where you're like, holy fuck, if I don't get to a toilet, I am literally going to shit my pants. And you've got to leg it. And then I've done that. We've all done it. I'm one of these people. If someone's been in the toilet and they're dirty bastard and they've pebble dashed it, I'm not going in that toilet. Same. But I remember, I don't even tell this fucking story. Now, this might be a stretch too far, but I remember New York, September 22, we were going to Vegas and we got internet connecting flights. And obviously we were 7 hours to New York and we were waiting to get to Vegas, but we had to go to the toilet in America. Have you been to America, Mike?
I've been to Mexico, but no, I've not yet been.
They have these weird toilets in America where there is a level of water above where we have them in the UK. So if you're too close to the finger, you're getting a bit of fucking splashback. It's bizarre.
I've seen them elsewhere. Yeah,
they're fucking weird. So you've got to put like toilet paper in and that. So in like JFK, we're there waiting to get the interconnecting flight. And I'm like, holy fuck. We had a few Proseccos, you know, had someone on the plane, you know, had someone at Manchester Airport. I'm like, oh no. And obviously in America as well, you've got this weird gap underneath where you can literally see what fucking trainers and undies you've got on the fucking toilets. The stalls are not like in the UK. You can look over the top if you want to. And I'm like, holy shit. And I walked in and like my stomach's in knots. Is it going to go? Is it going to? I'm thinking, I'm on a 4-hour flight to Vegas after this. There's no way I can go on the plane. And I went back in, went back out, went back in, and all the toilets, and it's fucking hammered. And in the end, I just had to let it go. And it was like a fucking bomb had gone off. And all I kept thinking was, I'm hovering going, oh my God, don't. And it was like some out of train spotting. And it just, every time we have a scene like that, it just reminds me of train spotting. It don't matter who you are, we can all say it doesn't happen. It's happened to the best of you because your body just goes, I tell you what, we're going to get you at this very fucking point. So yeah, that was definitely a train spotting moment. But there you go. Or what you do is, you do when, I did it the other year when you were going to Greece and was on the plane and I'm going, I'm sat next to this bloke we just got chatting to. It was some big boxer. He's fought Frank Bruno. He was a big fucker. And we were chatting, just having... I was drinking his wife's Prosecco in the end. He was giving me his wife's bottles of Prosecco. She was fuming. I was having a great time with him. But about an hour into the flight, I'm going, oh, no, I need the toilet and I will not go on a plane. I was like, no, no, no. And I had to go on a plane and I fucking got in there and I was trying to be as quick as possible so it looked like I'd had a piss, really. And then, you know, I'm there like, please, please. And I had to go twice. And the second time, oh, my God, it was like a fucking atomic bomb had gone off. The fucking smell was disgusting. So as I opened the door, this woman's there with fucking a couple of people. I went, sorry, look, who's been in before? It's disgusting. Oh, my God. I'm the guy before me. And then sat on the plane like this, even getting my passport and that. I was fucking looking in the eye. Oh, it was disgusting. But yeah, then sort of scenes always remind me of Trainspotting. I know it sounds stupid, but anyway, carry on. I've took it down an alleyway.
It is the most iconic one, though, isn't it? I think Dumb and Dumber has a pretty good scene as well. But I think because of the environment, you know, the worst toilet in Scotland, I just think it's absolutely brilliant. Fantastic. And like you say, for some people, I guess it gives you the old heaving feeling. But I mean, what do you think about some of the rest of the cast? So obviously the main kind of point of view character is Renton, but you've got some of his so-called friends. And again, I think this is they're kind of friends, but they're all like these misfits who just end up hanging out together. But what do you guys reckon to them?
Well, I mean, it's funny because there's a line from so Tommy, played by Kevin McKidd, who for people may know, he's in Grey's Anatomy. He's one of the main characters in Grey's Anatomy. And when Megan was watching, I was like, oh, you recognize him? And she's like, you what? I was like, it's you know, Kevin McKidd, the guy from Grey's Anatomy. She's like, shut up. And she's like, oh my God, because he's such a transformation, so different. And he's a very good looking chap as well. And in this, obviously, less so, especially what happens to him. But I think this is an ensemble cast. There's only about, I think it's about 15 named actors who have like a speaking role, but every one of them absolutely nails it. You know, you've got Spud played by Ewan Bremner, who's amazing and he's done loads of other great stuff. Obviously, Johnny Lee Miller, a sick boy. He went on to do Elementary and things. But, you know, Robert Carlyle, phenomenal actor. He's obviously, him and Ewan McGregor have done other work with Danny Boyle as well. But like Robert Carlyle as Begbie/Francis, like, Begbie is the worst human on earth. Yeah. And he's just like, there's a scene where Tommy is like, Begbie's like, oh yeah, I fought this guy and you know, he was giving me the eye. So I beat him up and then I beat, you know, Tommy at pool because he was playing like shite. And then, you know, a couple of days later, he's like, I spoke to Tommy because Tommy always tells the truth. That's his biggest character flaw. And he told me actually what happened. And it's got Begbie, who's just absolutely trolleyed and he's like, can't even stand up properly and all that stuff. And some nerdy guy eats a crisp. And then he goes absolutely fucking ballistic at him. And then Johnny's like, he's an absolute psychopath. You can't take him out anywhere. I was trying to lose the game. I thought he was going to fucking kill me. He's a mate, like, what'd you do? And it's like, it's an extreme version. But I think we've all, especially when we were sort of teenagers or maybe in our early 20s, there's always, you know, if you have a group of you, like an ensemble, there's almost always one person who's either a liability when they're drunk or they always want to fight people or they can't handle their drinks, they're always being sick and making a mess. Or there's someone who's just like kind of a piece of shit. But I think there are times where I think a lot of people, especially young men, you've got a friend who doesn't really treat their girlfriends that right. I'm not talking about like overt abuse or anything like that. Obviously, I wouldn't be friends with someone like that. But you know, someone and they're kind of like, you know, maybe they you know, kind of not really respecting women the way they should respect their girlfriends. You're like, you are a bit of a prick, but you are kind of a mate. So it's that you do kind of give mates a lot more of a pass. But if you met certain people when you're an adult, you'd go, this guy's a prick. Why would you spend more than 5 seconds with him? But if you know people from school, sometimes you just kind of give them that pass. And it's that kind of just environment of just everyone in this film is kind of a piece of shit in their own way. Certain characters less so, but even like Diane, the girlfriend character, you know, she seems okay. And then it turns out she's underage. And then it's like, and he's like, well, I'm not fucking touching you again. What the fuck? Why didn't you tell me you're at school with underage? This is illegal. I'm going to go to prison. Oh my God. And she's like, well, if you don't see me again, I'll tell the police. And you're like, oh, and in that situation, you're like, well, what do you do? But like, apart from that moment, she's a very cool character, very interesting character. And the actress who plays her, Kelly MacDonald, she plays Merida in Brave. So, and the dad as well, Peter Mullen, the dad who's James Cosmo, he's also in Brave as well. Yeah, as well. But like, the whole cast is so good, but every character has their own degree of complexities and own. No one's a good character. They're all kind of shit, but it's like, to what levels and what makes them kind of a piece of shit, if you know what I mean.
So I just want to say about the comedy of it, because it's not obvious, but if you think Begbie, he's absolutely terrible, you know, and he loves a good fight. Well, if this was a 6'4" broad-shouldered guy, you're like, oh, this is a dangerous guy. And to be fair, there are some horrible, violent scenes. But the fact that you've got this pipsqueak who is shorter than everyone going around like he's Bertie Big Bollocks, I think that is a great bit of like physical comedy for me. I think he's very intentionally chosen because of his small kind of stature. But again, I have to go back to that first time in the cinema of watching it, when Renton has the time of his life, you know, he's stolen Tommy's homemade porn video, hasn't he? Which gave him some stirrings, you know, which forced him to go to the club and stuff. And, you know, then, like I say, he has the time of his life. When she just appears in full school uniform, you're like, holy shit. Can you imagine the worst things? I have to say, she had the most chilled out parents that probably have ever existed. I mean, that to me seemed a bit strange. It's obviously, I think it's conveying that she does this sort of thing regularly, but I mean, fucking hell, you know, not under my roof. But yeah, the thing I find weird about it, I'd love to know what you guys think, right? So she's actually 19. And it's really interesting how they cast her. So apparently they were canvassing around, I think it was Glasgow, you know, putting up flyers and stuff and just getting a random unknown person to play this role. But she was 19, very inexperienced in terms of acting and stuff. But she is playing a 14-year-old. Hmm. And the sex scene is gratuitous, right?
Yep.
And it's like, yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I know she's not underage, but she is playing someone underage. And the thing is, like you say, there is a little bit of blackmail, but I think he could have handled it a different way. When he knows that she's 14, and he still goes back to have some sexy time with her. So, and it's not, they're never trying to portray that Renton is a great guy at all. But again, you're like, fucking hell, it's proper Jimmy Savile stuff, this.
Yeah. Sorry, Mike. Go on, Mike.
I was going to say, I think it's kind of, this film shows a lot of taboos, I think. And although I'm not, to clarify before I say this, I'm not condoning, you know, anyone having sex with someone underage. But what I'm saying is, nowadays we know a lot more about it. And, you know, I've been out in town and met someone and I'm thinking like, I've never been with anyone like substantially younger than me, but there's been times when you're like, in a situation where someone's in a club and they're drinking and stuff, you're thinking, if I ask you for your ID, if someone's, you know, seems to be coming on, you know, giving you the eye and seems, oh, maybe I can, you know, get some interaction with this person. If you then say, can I see your ID? It's a very weird situation to put yourself in. So I'm like, so you probably wouldn't, especially in like the 90s in that club, you would assume, and she obviously, the actress is 19, and you'd think, she does look 19, you know, she doesn't look like a 14-year-old girl. And it's that weird situation where it's like, I'm in no way, shape, or form condoning it. But it's not like he's actively a paedophile. It's not like he's going after school children. You know, his actual reaction when he finds out, even though he's a heroin addict and he's morally deplorable, he is like, oh, fuck, no, this is, you know, this is too far. I'm robbing old people. I'm like doing drugs. You know, I'm injecting myself. I'm fucking over my friends. I'm doing all this stuff. But that, knowing that I've just slept with someone who's, you know, underage, that's almost his line, which does actually kind of make you respect the character a little bit. Well, yes, but she does, to be fair, she does say, if you don't see me again, I'll call the police. And in that situation, what would you do? I'm sure there are other options, but it's that thing. That's a very difficult situation to be in. Obviously, don't get yourself in the situation to begin with, but it's one of those things where almost every situation in this is quite, maybe not morally gray, maybe a lot of them are very morally dark gray, but there's a way where, although almost everyone in this is a piece of shit, it's not like they're completely unlikable in such a way that you couldn't connect with him, you couldn't understand, you couldn't sympathize. There is a human element, which I think balances out a little bit. And I think that's what makes a lot of these scenes work, as opposed to it just being scene after scene after scene of just people being horrendous. It kind of has a bit more to it than that.
Yeah, and I think that it's the old honey trap, isn't it? You know, like the problem is, I'm the same with you, Dave, actually. When I watched it, I'm really like, you know the sex scene, she's completely naked, irrespective of her being 19. In the context of the movie, she's a teenager. And to actually show that on the screen, I don't think that sits very well. You wouldn't get away with that now at all. You know, even though an iconic movie, and we've covered some movies, haven't we, where you're like, oh, fucking hell, it's an iconic movie. But that's a bit close to the bone. But the thing is as well, is you're talking about like nightclubs and stuff like that. Yeah, and the parents are just like, well, yeah. And I think I might have told this story. When I was at school, two of the fittest girls in our school were like 13, 14. I haven't told you this, Dave. I don't know if I've ever said it on the podcast.
Yeah.
I remember being at school, not being able to compete. You know, I was still fucking, didn't have a clue, you know, what I'm doing. Just fucking absolutely fucking wanking myself silly. You know, no real idea. You know, you snogged a couple of girls, but that was it really. And they were going out with two guys who had cars. And they were like mid-20s. They were like 25, 26. I remember this girl saying, 26, always a real man and all this. And the lads at school were all, even like the ones who were like at school in proper relationship, you know, like school relationship. And they were like the cool ones, the good footballers or the tough, like the hard lads in the year, whatever. And I was always just sort of like middling. I was never anything really, you know what I mean? Like, but you would, and even then at the time, I wasn't like thinking, fucking pedos. I'm thinking, I can't compete with these fucking guys. He's got a fucking car. He's got a job. But when all of a sudden, when I got to like 17, 18, and you're thinking, holy shit, it's fucking pedos these two guys were. You know, and these girls were dead graphic about what was going on. They were picking him up. They were coming to the fucking school picking him up. I remember one lad come to pick one of the girls up and he got fucking leathered, to be honest. They were probably predators, but this lad absolutely was a box. He absolutely nailed one of them outside the school. It was a great fight, actually. But anyway, you know, it was a great fight as I walked to the Metrolink at Altrincham. But no, when you think about it, you think, holy fuck, they were actually fucking pedos. You know what I mean? But whereas this is that old thing of bouncers not letting the girls in. They would always check always letting the girls in if they looked old enough. Whereas the lads always got checked for ID. You know what I mean? I think I got checked once when I was 15, when I was going to Manchester. And, in some respects, I suppose at 15, 16, well, 16 was all right, but I went to Manchester a couple of times at 15 and I did all right for myself. You know, when you think about it and you're thinking that's sort of like a, you know, it's roles reversing. It's not right, but in the context of the meal, like Dave said, he's going back the second time. And I think what it does, you're saying about like Begbie and all that, and I think he's a great character. Like, I mean, we were talking this to me and Dave and I'd not quite finished the movie and he said, yeah, but he's a nutter twat. And I'm like, I'd only, you know, the bit... So I've got a story. So I went out with a girl around 97. I met her on holiday and she was my first proper girlfriend. She lived in Swansea, right? So we'd met her in Benidorm, and this is true. I ended up copping off with this girl on one side of the club, and my brother, who was supposed to be doing his GCSE fucking exams and revision, and he didn't give a fuck. He just fucking went and went to Benidorm for like 10 days or something. There was three of us went. He's copping off with this other girl. I was with the blonde girl. He's with this brunette on the other side of this club in Benidorm. I think it was the Beachcomber, which is still there. And they were sisters. And it was they were both from Wales. You know, we didn't realise. He comes over and goes, I've just copped off with this girl. And I'm like, so have I. You know, like, and it's like, and they were fucking sisters. And it's like, they've just copped off with brothers as well. So anyway, I won't go into graphic detail how that went, but we basically went down to Swansea a couple of times. So the second time, my best mate, Burnsy, he was like, we used to call him the peck and pouncer because he definitely should have had some investigation. When we look now, he never really got off with the girls or anything. But anyway, he come down.
Sorry to cut across you, but is going down to Swansea a euphemism?
Well,
is that kind of linguistic?
I learned a lot, David. I learned a lot, definitely. But no, so anyway, when we got down there, it was like summer, so we'd met him in the June and 97, I think it was. And then we went down in like the August or something. I forget, because Teddy Sheringham signed for United and Cantona retired. I was gutted. But anyway, in Benidorm, I got told that, which I was devastated about. But anyway, let's carry on with the story. So we go down there and it's red hot, like day in Swansea. And we're going to this place called the Mumbles, which is like, it's like a pier and everything. And this girl's with, she's like, she put knee-high boots on. And I'm going, that wasn't complaining at the time. I was like, why are you wearing knee-high boots? She's like, a minute, I don't get it. She went, you'll understand when we go in this club. And I was like, I don't get it. So we go in this club and we're dancing away and everything. All of a sudden, this bottle hits me on the fucking shoulder. And I was like a Budweiser bottle or something. And I'm like, what the fuck's going on? I thought like someone was ready to fucking have a fight with me or something. You know, I was going to get cracked over the head or something. And I'm like, so I turn around, Adam turns around, my brother and my mate Bernie. We're like, what the fuck? So we're these three of us and we're thinking, oh, we're going to get, the Manchester lads are going to get absolutely hammered here. So my brother's not behind the door for kicking off. So he's like, who the fuck's done next minute? Another bottle comes and it smashed at your feet. And she looked at me, this girl who was with me, and she went, that's why you wear knee high boots at Y Shop, because in this club, when people have finished their drinks, they just fucking throw them in the air.
Oh, and my God.
I was like, are you, you know, you think bullshit. And it was like a scene out of a next minute, a pint pot ends up at your feet. And it was like some fucking Western that you'd seen, you know, they have a big scrap in these glass. And I was going, I don't get it. And it was just bottles, like, not like people were lobbing them, but when they finished them, they were doing a beg bin, just going, and just throwing them. And I've never been so scared in my life. I was like, well, I'm definitely getting off the dance floor now. And she said, that's why I've got knee-high boots on, because you can't wear high heels in here because you fucking cut your legs. And I was like, oh my God, that is fucking bizarre. I was like, I've never heard it since. And it was one of them things that stuck with me. So when you saw Trainspotting probably after this or around this, I was like, they're doing a fucking beg me there. What's going on? See, because on the stairs, they're going, nobody's fucking leaving here till we find him. And he goes, who the fuck are you? And he just goes, oh, kicks him in the bollocks and they have a big scrap, don't they? But yeah, honestly, another thing that I relate to Trainspotting is that I've never been so scared in a fucking club thinking I was going to get potted or something. It was bizarre.
You wouldn't have thought it. Well, it obviously did take him a while to think, maybe we should replace the glass
with plastic, yeah.
With plastic. Honestly. You know, maybe that would be better. Because they have to clean that shit up as well. So,
yeah, because I remember the beer going down my top and I was like, what the fuck's going on? You know, like, but yeah, I wasn't ready for a fight that night, Dave. I was like, no, we need to get out of here pretty quick. Yeah. Well, there you go.
Her reaction to that, I'm just like, oh yeah, let's keep going to this club and let's just wear knee-high boots. I'm like, don't go to this fucking club. Like,
stop going to the club.
You are doing like you're really normal. Hey, I just changed my shoes. You know, people throwing glass. I just changed my shoes. Like, what is this? What weird normalization is this? But I will say with Trainspotting, because there's a couple of iconic scenes I want to mention. One of them is the sex scene thing we tackle, which is, you know, you've got you get to see Ewan McGregor's and Ewan Bremner's penises, which is good fun. Especially, you know, shout out to Rhea of Femon, hashtag release the dogs. And when we watch this, Megan's favorite scene that really makes her giggle is after Renton's had sex with Diane and she's like, right, you need to get out now. And he's like, wait, what? And he's like, get out. You can stay here if you want, but you need to stay in the hallway. And he's like, what? Just give her the clothes and pushes him out. And then it closes and it's just his silhouette. And then he pulls the condom off his penis and it just flops in the silhouette. And she cracks up at that. Oh. She thinks it's so funny. Yeah. And I just like, with the sex scene, it always makes me laugh. And every time I watch it, it makes me laugh more, which is, you know, he swaps out the sex tapes and things. And then a little bit later on, you know, Tommy and his girlfriend are trying to watch sex tapes and they watch the football game of, you know, 100 best goals or whatever. And then, like when Renton, you know, he's having sex with Diane and it's like, oh, they score. And, you know, it's that they both finish and stuff. And it's like, oh, I haven't felt that good since, you know, this goal back then. And then you're seeing the goal that he's referring to because it's on the thing, which they thought. And I'm like, these little details are just so clever and funny. And the dialogue, again, like Pulp Fiction, is so snappy. A lot of the dialogue is such normal stuff. Like half of Sick Boy's dialogue is him talking about comparing 007 movies or doing Sean Connery impressions. And it adds nothing to the plot, but it makes him a real person. And that's what I think connects with people like Tarantino and Danny Boyle does it in other films, which is when you get characters who have real conversations, just about benign, pointless shit, you know, a Royale with cheese, like that kind of shit, that makes a character so much more relatable immediately. Just, I mean, even with like the MCU, when Captain America's talking about his list, you know, in Winter Soldier, and he's got there and he's got like the music he needs to check out and like the films he needs to see and stuff like that, it just brings a level of realism and just that, oh yeah, these are pseudo real people. But the sex scenes, the way it's put together, the way it's edited is just, it's so funny and so clever the way it's put together. But I've got a note here which I've just written, what the fuck is Renton wearing in the club where he meets Diane? He's got this weird little crop top that's terrible, but I think I realize why. I think I've figured it out, because in the scene I was watching it and I was like, why is he wearing this? And also, who would ever go out with someone wearing that kind of
I'm
thing?
I'm impressed that he's pulled. To
I know. Like, and also, you know, not to stereotype, but if someone was wearing that in a club in that era, you wouldn't necessarily assume they're heterosexual. You know, that's the kind of, that was a vibe that I loosely got. I don't know if that was just myself and Megan, but And you're thinking, how do you pull that? You don't look good in that. And I think I realized, because throughout the film, you see all his T-shirts are too small. And I think it's because he never has bought clothes for himself in his adult life. So all of his clothes are stuff that's still at his parents that he's been wearing since he was basically had clothes bought for him. And I think, apart from a coat that he wears, that's what, and the jeans he wears are tiny, small, like skinny jeans stuff. Mm. I think that's why. And I only just clocked it on this kind of watch because I was like, what is the reason? Why is he wearing that? And again, I just think it's so many cool small details involved.
I didn't pick up on that at all. But I absolutely think you're right. Because when he's in his bedroom, you've got all the trains, you know, the yeah. train wallpaper and stuff. It is like a kid's bedroom, isn't it? So, you know, he's probably been in this state for, you know, a decade or so and never really, you know, kind of grown up.
Mm-hmm. And that's drug addiction, though, isn't it? And I think you're right. I think the griminess of, like, the world that they're in, even when, you know, he goes to London, doesn't he? You know, ultimately, he gets away with not getting sent down, doesn't he? You know, and Spud gets sent down and he goes to London and it...
Can I ask, right, why, though? I didn't pick up on why did he get away with it and Spud went down? I didn't understand that.
I think it's because where Spud's a bit of a simpleton, he showed no remorse. He wasn't really he basically was being questioned, like, do you feel bad for stealing? And I think he said Spud shows no remorse. So I think Spud was like, yeah, I had to steal because I needed the money or whatever. Whereas Renton's a very intelligent character. And I think when you realize anything he puts his mind to, he actually succeeds at, even the job in London. Mm. And I think he realized that if he goes hard on the need to be rehabilitated, the heroin kind of piling on that. Whereas Spud was just like, why'd you do it? He's like, well, I need the money. And you notice Spud, he's got no, he hasn't got the best social skill. And he's very, you ask him a question, he's quite to the point. So I think it was that Spud just came across as a simpleton that stole. And Mark went on the fact that he was a heroin addict. And I think his parents probably helped. That's at least what I think happened. I suspect the book might delve into it more, but I've not read the book because it's written in phonetic Scottish. And it's a tough read.
Yeah, I know he was laying on the sympathy or the remorse, but I thought there must be something else to get him off, you know. But maybe it is just that for the story. I can't.
Maybe Spud's been caught before.
Too often.
Like, because Spud's a bit. They say keep calling him an idiot. And I think maybe he's been caught before as well because they loosely mention he's a habitual stealer or so, a habitual thief. I think they use the term. So I suspect maybe Renton's got away with not being caught, whereas Spud probably has. That's what I guess.
Yeah,
I think so. And I think, like, it's funny, Dave, because when you said about Begbin, I was like, oh, he's a fucking iconic character. But as soon as he goes to London, and obviously they get the whole backstory of him, you know, he's fucking on the run, basically, you know, for armed robbery and that. And that's where he does become an absolute see you next Tuesday, doesn't he? Because you're just like, you're a cock. You know, and even Sick Boy coming down, like, no matter where, I think what it shows is with addiction, I think what's very clever and subtle is no matter where Renton goes, he can't get away from that life. And I don't necessarily mean that. I think what I get out of it is someone who's addicted, they might be able to get rid of all the friends. I think in some respects, the London scenes is not necessarily them being there in real person. They are in the film, but in context of that monkey's always on your back where you're like, oh, I can never get away from this. From what I've done, the life, you know, the temptation of the drugs. And they just like pull him back in, don't they, to this world. And I think that, as much as the physically there as character, I think the message is you're never going to get away from that for the rest of your life. You're going to be fighting that addiction, aren't you? And I think no matter how successful he is, I mean, fuck me, Devin, you know me better than you know this better than anyone. £320 a fucking month somewhere in London to rent was fucking, you couldn't even get that for a day probably now, the way it is in central London. But that whole bit with Begbie and that, and obviously you've got Keith Allen as well, haven't you? He's like the infiltrator and stuff of like, and it's all dead calm. But what, like you said about the misfits though, they're in the room and that, you know, they're doing this deal and fucking Spud, you know, these people are obviously big time drug dealers, aren't they? He's got his henchmen. He goes out, he's weighing it. You know, he's out the room. He's like the facilitator. And then Spud's there like with them fucking shades on like this going, had the glasses on like that, you know, and it's like, you could never look more wired or like you are just basically a load of fucking smackheads who've just come across this, you know, drug deal thing. It's just, it's funny, isn't it? You know, and they're trying to play like gangsters and even like Renton, like you said, Mike, what a great observation. He's got, basically, he looks like he's from 2024. He's got fucking skinny jeans on, Converse, a fucking T-shirt. He's a proper hipster, isn't he? You know what I mean? But he's almost like, he's come full circle, his outfit. But that at the time, more than anything was because he was just like, it's what a great observation. He was living probably in the same clothes what he left school in, because he's 26. He's probably had 10 years of addiction, you know, and this is where we're at. So I think that is, and I've not even thought of that, but that is an amazing explanation, Mike, of the movie. Because I said to Dave yesterday, I wasn't sure, like, well, am I enjoying it as much and everything, but just, and I knew this would happen. I always do this. I'm always like a bit cold on summer. And then I've watched the end of the movie, and Dave and yours explanations on the characters and that, it's sort of elevated, I think, as well, like how important it is, because it does show real drug addiction and what the effects are, and the squalor that these people live in, that they're not asked about. Even all the friends, like you said, they're all going to undermine each other because they're addicts. They need money. They need to score. They need to. So they're always, even all the friends, because nobody else likes them and put up with their stealing and shitty ways, but they're all doing it to each other. So it's sort of accepted in that world. So yeah, I think it's a great description of like drugs addiction, really, in some respects. And it's still iconic now, 28 years later. It doesn't age where you go, things have changed. It hasn't. When people are on heroin and stuff like that, this is the life they lead, no matter how good technology is or whatever the world evolves. It's still the same.
Yeah. I mean, you spoke about Spud in the corner there. I mean, he is one of my favorite characters. Absolutely iconic. And Ewan Bremner, he apparently played, so this was like a stage play before, so it was a book and then it was a play, and so he played Renton in that. But he didn't have the film star good looks for Renton, apparently. So that's why they cast kind of Ewan McGregor there. But my favorite bit, to be honest, is still where he's, you know, he at least knows he's got to try and get a job, and he's a bit nervous about it. So he goes for the interview and he has a bit of coke, you know, to get him in the zone. Was it speed? Was it? I thought it was coke. But
I can vouch for that, yeah.
Yeah, but it's when he gets asked about, you know, what attracts him to the leisure industry. It's like, in a word, pleasure. It's like, my pleisure in other people's leisure. It's like, the way he delivers it is amazing. And that is a proper laugh out loud moment. I love the character. Just quick plug for our 1,000th Comics in Motion episode, of course. I don't know if you picked up on this, Chris, but I think Tony was saying, you are Spud.
How I didn't dare even you?
Pick up, I didn't even pick up on it in real time, but I was listening back. I was like, oh, what a coincidence, like, that we're about to talk about it.
Well, the actor as well, he's so good because he's in Wonder Woman. He's the PTSD stricken sniper.
Yeah.
And it's whenever I see any of these actors and anything else, like Johnny Lee Miller again, a sick boy, phenomenal. And I think that scene, I think one of the reasons this film works again is because although it's a very, very dark film, it sprinkles in enough humor and it's fast enough that it's not like swimming in depression. You know, I'm sure we'll talk about it in a moment as we're getting towards the end, but like there's the big scene in the middle that's just horrendous. Every time you watch it, death is just awful. But the thing is, this film could easily spend the rest of the film dwelling on that moment and you just being stuck in this misery cycle of that moment. That could happen. Same with the stuff that happens to Tommy, but it doesn't. It moves on in a way that, A, in real life, you know, even if you're not an addict or something, with certain things that happen in your life, it will change you, but you the world won't stop moving for you, which is really, really difficult. And I think that the way this film kind of moves on from thing to thing, it makes you not get stuck in this just, you know, the film. If this film was directed by, say, David Fincher, it would probably be one of the most depressing films ever made. But because it's got that fast-pacedness, the music and everything like that, it makes it so it can tackle these really dark, powerful issues. I mean, it tackles the HIV and AIDS epidemic and things, which Megan, she recently watched It's a Sin, which is more from the homosexual perspective on when the AIDS epidemic happened in the UK. And it's a really, really... I haven't seen the show.
Great show.
I've heard it's brilliant and it's really dark. But she's like, after watching It's a Sin and then seeing what happens with Tommy... With the, you know, when there's the written in like red, don't know if it's blood or what, on the wall of his like flat saying, you know, like dirty blood and all this horrible stuff about him. And he's just had the worst luck of anyone. Knowing about how people were treated at that time when they had this disease, it just adds another layer of it. But you've watched it the first time. I remember watching it and I didn't really get it. I was like, oh, he's a heroin addict. And then, oh, they're calling him dirty because he's a heroin addict. And then he died. But actually, no, it's about him, you know, because Mark gets the test and all this stuff. And it's like, there is this whole film. You could almost split it into like four or five parts. You could almost do like an hour or two podcasts in each part of the film, just on the social commentary, the music, the acting, all of it. And it's just put together so well. And one scene I wanted to mention before, I imagine we'll get into the depressing part, is that speech that Renton gives after, like, Tommy's dumped after the whole sex tape thing, which obviously is completely Renton's fault, is when they go out and they go for, like, the great outdoors for a walk. And he's like, come on, guys, let's go for a walk. And he's like, I don't want to be out here. This sucks. Like, and Sick Boy's like, look, I know your girlfriend's giving you a hard time, but you don't need to take it out on us. And he's like, don't you proud to be Scottish? And then Renton's like, it's shite being Scottish. And I've written one of my, it's my favorite, like, bit of dialogue in the whole film. And it's like, the English are wankers, but I don't hate them because we were colonized by wankers. So what does that make us? And I'm like, that is so good. It's just so, it's like we couldn't even have a good culture to be colonized by. And it's like, it's so clever. It's so brilliant. I just love it.
I wondered if that was almost, that line, like, was that for the American market as well? Like, I don't know. There was something, it didn't resonate quite as much in the same way for me. I just, it felt slightly clunky. I just felt like it wasn't for the English or it wasn't for the Scottish, you know, it was more for the Americans. And, you know, at the start of this movie as well, they did have to really soften the Scottish accents because, you know, the American audience wouldn't basically understand it.
Don't they? At one point in the club, they've got the subtitles when Tommy and Spud are talking about the relationship issues. And it's got the bit between the girls and the boys and the girls and the boys, but it's got subtitles.
Yeah.
But that was quite clever as well. I love the use of subtitles in this. I love clever subtitles like they do in like Scott Pilgrim and Wanted to a degree, like clever cinematography camera work to kind of be like a little nudge wink to the audience. I love that stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, we've alluded to it a couple of times there, but obviously one of the most harrowing scenes is obviously with the baby dying.
Yeah.
And the way that scene unfolds, you know, Renton, I mean, as he's narrating over the whole movie, he's saying, you know, I don't know how long she was screaming for. And, you know, it all becomes obvious. And the effects, you can tell this is, you know, for a gritty British movie, this is big money. But, you know, in normal global terms, certainly in American terms, it's on a shoestring, isn't it? So all the special effects are very practical. But there's something about the effect with that baby where it's just horrendous, you know. And I remember this is the thing that knocked me sick in particular, that first time of watching it, and you're left scarred by it. But, you know, the way it unfolds, and obviously Sick Boy, it seems like he's the dad, and it was a bit of a mystery before. But, you know, Renton's coping strategy is to basically cook up, you know. Yeah. It's just... it's so well done. And like you say, it moves on from it. I think the whole going cold turkey as well, that's quite a horrendous scene. And McGregor is brilliant in that, you know. But yeah, what did you guys make of that?
I think just as a parent, Dave, you see it yourself, you know, your kids are your most precious thing, you know. I think you're right. The budget, you can tell. Look, it was a small budget, and some of the effects are good, like the drug effects and things like that. But that scene, I think what it shows is, obviously, even in death, their craving for drugs just carries on. It's just another day. It's a loss. There's a bit of, like, you know, I suppose it's one of, there's always going to be grief. But again, it fuels the drug addiction, doesn't it? It's another excuse to carry on. And I think that's why I see it as, that's why it just carries on into another scene. Then, you know, you get the little bit of a fallout, but there's nothing, it's not lingered on, like you say. I think you're correct. It's not something that goes on for the rest of the movie. It's not even mentioned really for the rest of the movie after that, is it? It's all about, like, Begbie and his fucking fucked up drug deal and stuff in London after that. But yeah, it is. It's not iconic, but it's also very brave to put that in, because it's one of the things in movies they don't usually do they? You know, children and stuff like that. But yeah, I think with addiction, I think that's what makes it more powerful.
I think that everything in this movie, especially being a succinct like 93 minutes, every single part in it, every single thing in this movie is just so succinct. There's no wasted space. There's no wasted time. It's nothing like that. It's all just very they don't make it overly gratuitous. Like a scene where you have the death of someone, either an infant or younger, is horrendous. You know, it's probably the worst thing you could possibly see on film, apart from sexual abuse to someone of that age as well. And when you have it in a film, you have to be very, very careful, understandably so. You have to make sure you do it in the best way, which is a really weird thing to say about it. But I think that the camera just stops on the passed away baby Dawn for just a second or so, and you see it. And I remember Megan on this watch, she said, oh, look at it. How long has it been like that?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't look fresh. It looks it's been there a long time. And it's like, it makes it even worse. And obviously with the dialogue, as you mentioned, Dave, which is like where it's like, she could have been screaming for hours. She could have been screaming for weeks. And you think, how long had that happened before she even noticed? And that's the real, the weight behind it. And as you say, like the addiction, like what do they do when they're confronted with this? How do they cope with it? Well, they don't cope with it. All roads lead back to heroin in this film. And I think that's the whole film, is like this misery cycle. He mentions, you know, life sucks, it's horrendous, it's a cycle of misery. And it's because of this heroin is just making you kind of go down this plug hole of going down this dark life.
But as well, I just think it's another example where, and a more obvious example where it's their coping strategy. They have an absolute shit life. And in that moment, you know, it is particularly shit, you know, this horrible, horrible thing. And so their coping strategy is to go to the drugs. So it's not, were their lives great? Were they fantastic before they became heroin addicts? Or did they kind of turn to that because it was so shit and it was a bit of escapism? So there's never any blanket, it's this or it's that, but it just gets you thinking. And you're right. I mean, the baby does look decomposed. And I was thinking, well, it was the whole flat just off their tits for weeks or something. I mean, it does look, you know, it's not fresh, is it? Like you say, the effects of it. And it never really pauses on it. There's no resolution because, unfortunately, you know, you do get cot deaths and things. There are, you know, babies that unfortunately die and they're well looked after. But yeah, this seems to be the implication is they were probably like that for weeks, and then she almost sort of forgot that she had a baby, and it's probably starved to death.
It's harrowing. It's absolutely horrendous. But again, it's done in that way where when I think of Trainspotting, I don't think of the baby scene. I know that's the two, because when he's coming off and he's going cold turkey, you get the sort of ceiling baby part. But it's one of those things in this film where the toilet scene's iconic. Obviously, the baby passing away is as well, but like the music is, the running scene. It's just almost like every single scene has something you can pull out of it. And when I think of Trainspotting, I don't think of any specific scene. I think of it as a whole package. And I think that's one of the things that's really hard to do. This film is very balanced, but I think as well with the addiction thing, and you know, all roads lead to heroin, and the way they react to the death of Dawn is, I think with addiction, a lot of it is circumstance and boredom. And I'm sure Blake, because obviously Blake's studied a lot of psychology and things, so he'll probably know a lot more about this than I do. But there's this experiment which a lot of people like to use as an example, and it's they kind of misquote it in certain ways, which is the rat that's given cocaine. It does it and 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 dies. And that's the idea that people have used to try and argue against drug addiction, things like that. But when you actually look into the study, there's just a rat by itself who had nothing to do apart from drink and do cocaine. And when they did the study like a revised version, they had two rats. They had one who was being social, who had like lots of rat friends and rats of different genders, the opposite gender, so they could, you know, have some fun time with, as well as lots of food and that sort of stuff. And they gave that rat the ability to have
cocaine. I would watch this cartoon or sitcom, by the way, but go on.
Okay. No,
but sounds like, great.
But like this rat, and essentially you got these two rats, and the one that has nothing to do just does cocaine and cocaine and cocaine and dies. But the one that has, you know, a socializing life, food and lots of stuff to do, lots of toys, it does it once or twice, like a little bit, but it doesn't really actually do cocaine very much, even though cocaine's one of the most addictive substances on the planet. And it shows really that circumstance plays such a massive role in not only drug use, but drug addiction. You know, a rich person who can do drugs all the time, they're not viewed as an addict in the same way because they've got money, their life isn't necessarily falling apart because they can be a recreational user. But with something like heroin, especially when you haven't got any money and you're living off the dole, it becomes an all-encompassing thing. And as shown, when Sick Boy and Renton first give up and they have that scene in the park and they're talking and stuff, and Sick Boy obviously comes off just to basically mock Mark, they do that thing where they try it for a while and then they go, yeah, we came to the decision, let's just go back on heroin because life is difficult and it's boring and you have to deal with jobs and all this sort of stuff. And heroin is, in their view, it's the easy way out, even though the life is harder because you only have to focus on one thing. And that's something Nikki Sixx says in the Heroin Diaries book that I mentioned earlier, which is he says, and Russell Brand, he said it in Get Him to the Greek as well. And it's like, you know, there's examples in media with heroin addicts saying that when you're on heroin, all you need to think about is heroin. And it's because if there's nothing else, if there's other things, everything else in your life is a bit shit, you, it's something to focus on and kind of put the blinders on to everything else. And that's, again, with the Death of Dawn, is that they just put the blinkers up. They focus on the only thing they want to focus on, and that is heroin. And it's just, it's brutal. But again, it's so well thought out on film.
No, it is. It is. And I think as well, like, if you get to like the, towards the end, and you're right, it just moves on. Life moves on in their world because it's just about this. But you can say, you can see Renton just wants to get out and obviously set this deal up. I said it before, but it's only 16 grand. You know, like he says 20. They're not good negotiators. I said about Spud, and they're happy with that. But ultimately, Begbie's just done too many shitty things to think, well, we can't have him walking off into the sunset with, you know, with the money, with the stash, everything. And Renton obviously wants to be free. The whole thing is, I want to be free. And when he has that fight in the pub, you know, that guy spills a drink on him. It's purely an accident. It's all Begbie's fault. But it's like, Renton's just like, oh, fuck's sake, here we go again. But ultimately, these are the things that like catch him out, don't they, in the end? And you've got to have some sort of positive to it. The positive is he's got a chance to make a life. And I've never seen the second one, but you sort of like, I'm happy with the payoff. And I do like the fact that he does look after Spud as well and gives Spud a little backhander, you know. But, you know, he's walked away with 12 grand there. He's not going to fucking, you know, suddenly be a millionaire, but it gives him enough to start somewhere else. And I think that's the satisfaction bit I get of the movie. Despite all the harrowing things that are in it, there is a nice ending, you know, you're hoping hope, that he turns his life. Yeah, there's hope, basically, over all of it. So, yeah. No, I do like
gets arrested as well, which is nice.
Exactly, yeah, he needs it, Mike. He's a twat, but there you go. At the end.
We're to wrap up, but there's one thing I just want to mention, just another line of dialogue. It's my second favorite line of dialogue in the whole thing. And it's nearer the end, and it's when Begbie is in the club and then with Renton in London, and then he gets off with a person who seems to be a man. I don't know if it's a drag queen or someone who's transgender, but it's someone who appears to be a woman but has the genitals of a biological man. And the line from Renton is, 1,000 years from now, there'll be no boys, there'll be no girls. Yeah. Just wankers. And I'm like, that is such like a weirdly progressive idea from someone who's a deplorable human being, who's like a heroin addict and all this sort of stuff and does some horrible stuff in the film. And what I really like about it is just that kind of thing. Even he is not fazed by the idea of people being trans or people being gay or anything like that. He doesn't care. He's like, boys, girls, I don't give a shit. You're all wankers. And it's like, even in that way, it makes him just a little bit more likable. And that's just that clever dialogue of just being like, that's quite, and the way society is going, it is basically kind of going that way. You know, the lines of gender is being fuzzy, which I'm for. I don't care what people want to do with themselves. But I'm like, even in a film from 96, just have that little line. And you just go, it's just a weird little clever drop of the writer, Irvin Welsh, and the makers of this film are just like, they're still, in a weird way, kind of progressive, even in a film about heroin addicts. And it's just this, I just love that line, along with the line I mentioned earlier. And it's just, you know, the English are wankers, but the Scots were colonized by wankers. Both of those lines are just so iconic. It's great.
Absolutely. And on that note, should we get into our final review?
Let's go. So, Mike, you're the guest. It's usually me jumps in first. What are you going to score this one, mate?
I honestly can't remember your rating systems here because I always have got it in my mind with comics in motion. Remind me, remind the audience in case this is their first time.
Fucking remind myself, actually. You're right. So if it's the worst thing we've ever seen, it's gone to Alderaan. If it's a little bit better, but it's still a hot piece of garbage, you know, it's going to Elm Street. If it's in the middle, it's Hill Valley. If it's a good movie, but not absolutely amazing, it's Pleasantville. And if it's the best, one of the best movies you've ever seen, can't recommend it enough, it's Cloud City. So
yeah,
we know where we're going. But anyway, go on.
It's Cloud City for me. I think this is, and I didn't, I think I hinted and I led to it, but I think this is one of the best films ever made. I think, and Megan, oddly enough, surprised me. We've done an Afterthoughts on it, but we'll be releasing that after this comes out, so it doesn't spoil it. She agreed. She said that without me pushing her for that. I think this is one of the best films ever made because I don't know anyone who's watched this film who can deal with some of the things that are in this who don't enjoy it. I think that you can't really critique the film. As a whole, you know, there might be the odd thing you can question, you know, maybe the Scottish speech doesn't hit Dave in the same way it hits us. And obviously a lot of it is really hard-hitting stuff. But as a film, as a dialogue, as the acting, there's no part in this film where you go, that scene doesn't work, or this bit feels out of place, or this bit. All of it feels so well constructed. Everyone in this is doing such a great job. It's just a film where I just think it's unlike any other film. It's incredibly unique. It created so many things. It had a real impact on culture. There's very few British films that have the weight to it like this does. It's got a lot to say social commentary wise. It's just got everything you'd want in it and more. And every time I watch it, I find something new to enjoy. And I just cannot fault it. And it's been a part of my life since I was young. And obviously that does, you know, there's a connection there, a nostalgic connection. But I've never seen a film like this since. And it's even the sequel, which is all right. I just think that anyone who hasn't seen this film, obviously we've just spoiled the hell out of it, so I hope they have. I just think not quite everyone needs to see this film because there's some people who this would definitely, you know, really negatively affect due to some of the subject matter. But I just think if you can handle what happens in this film, it's a must watch. I think it's one of the most important British films ever made. And I think it's one of the most, I think it's in the top 10 best films ever made, to be completely honest with you. I absolutely adore this film. So thank you for letting me make you guys watch it.
Oh, good stuff. Because I think for me, I was saying, we were chatting this, I'm not sure I'm enjoying it as much, but I think talking about it, watching it, you know, to completion, I would say it is an absolutely one of the most iconic British movies ever. The soundtrack, the things around our age. I mean, we were like late teens, weren't we, Dave, when this came out? It was, for me, it was quite an important movie. And like I say, like Pulp Fiction was out, iconic VHS cover. This, again, everyone knows, whether it's the music, the VHS cover, you know, even as we're talking about, I'm talking about little things that have happened in my life that I still look back to train spotting, you know, like if I need to pebble dash somewhere, I think of train spotting toilets. Nothing can ever beat that, but there you go. So I'm going to send it to Pleasantville, actually. I don't think it's one of my favourite films ever, but I think it's one of the best British movies. And yeah, it's just a pop culture icon reference, whether it's the characters, the various different things that are relatable that have happened to myself in my life. So yeah, great acting and great movie as well. So what about yourself, Dave?
So as I was watching it and I was enjoying it, I was thinking my headspace was somewhere between Pleasantville and Cloud City. I wasn't too sure as I was going in, but on reflecting, you know, thinking about the writing, thinking about the actor's performance, you know, the I talked about when Ewan McGregor doubles over when he's dying for a shit. You know, the cinematography of it is done really well, I think, as well. The music, it's just amazing. It has tipped me over the edge, to be honest. So it's a Cloud City for me. I think this, pardon the pun, shits all over something like Four Weddings and a Funeral, which was held up as this British amazing movie and whatever. I definitely do think it's one of the most iconic British movies, but also one of the most real, you know, the kind of nonsense. If you've got Hugh Grant, befuddled Hugh Grant, being, oh, I'm so charming, and you know, it's you can't relate to that. But you know, certainly we're probably down near the other end of the spectrum, aren't we? Where we're closer to the council estates and you know,
we're not high society. Like
yeah,
no, exactly. No, you're right.
So, you know, we're not sort of clinking champagne glasses and whatever. So yeah, Cloud City for me. And I did buy this one as well rather than rent it, because I had a feeling, I was like, oh yeah, I need this one in my collection again.
I got it on DVD, but I want to upgrade to Blu-ray. But
you're going to have to, nice. Mike, I think. Mm. But now, Mike, you are here for my pick for next week. So you're getting behind the curtain. Now, we have watched one of the most iconic movies ever in your pick. But it's my pick, Mike. Now, we're going to be picking... I have picked a movie where we've just recently lost the amazing Carl Weathers, you know, star of Rocky. And I wasn't actually looking for a Carl Weathers movie, but I've got a Carl Weathers movie. And it also stars Martin Cove out of Karate Kid, Sensei Kreese. But it also stars an absolute legend. Well, there's two legends, actually. There is Gene Simmons' missus, Shannon Tweed, who is also a Playboy bunny, who I may have watched some of her softcore movies in the past. She's in this as a co-star, but the main star is Mr. Terry Jean Bollea. Now, you may not know who that is, but Mike, this is one of the greatest actors ever. So we are going to cover the 1997 straight-to-video movie, which is only available on YouTube. It's not available anywhere else because they've gone, fuck that, we're not even being associated with this pile of garbage. Shadow Warriors Assault on Devil's Island. So let's get into the trailer.
No fear. No rules. No equal. Meet the Masters.
So what's it going to be, huh? We have a team here or what?
Let's move.
An ex-Navy SEAL whose terror is dynamite.
That wig is the best.
Follow me.
An undercover expert who's always dressed to kill.
Nothing to a see what her character's going to be like in the film,
got a talent for destruction. Oh, it gets worse.
This is a covert operation.
We are being held hostage.
Devil's Island is a fortress.
The only way in is underwater.
When the government has a job they can't handle,
this calls for decisive action.
They call the experts.
I need your help.
I am not going back into that jungle.
Sure you are.
No, I'm not.
You know you are. I always do.
We're not landing until I see the hostages.
Can you see her?
What do you do? What, go back in the jungle?
Men die in our business.
Yeah.
That's our business.
Time is right now.
That was definitely ridiculous.
Oh, that was a good kick.
You won't see them. You won't hear them. But when innocent lives are at stake, she will
Billy Blanks is in it as well, yes.
Yeah. I didn't name
terrorists are in control.
Go! Legend, Tybo, like...
Somebody's gotta take moving. Charge.
Move. This trailer has more explosions in it than anything I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Every 5th second there's an explosion.
Hulk Hogan. The legend.
Shannon Tweed. Carl Weathers. Fighting for everyone who can't fight
Shannon
back.
Tweed's basically just in a fucking bra there.
That's it. She's either in a bra or a shirt. That seems to be
Assault
it.
Assault on Devil's
Tactical
Island.
Tactical fighting attire.
What a movie. Now, Mike, wow. I know you're blown away. I don't want you turning around and saying that this will be as good as Trainspotting. But anyway...
Yeah.
So, just
I won't be watching along. Just to clarify,
no.
I can be on. You guys can watch that one. I'll just hear you afterwards. That's fine. That can be a little delve in.
Fair enough. So, big thank you, Mike, for coming on. If you want to email us, the VHSStrikesBack@gmail.com. If you want to follow us on social media at VHSStrikesBack, as always, please drop us a review on your podcast catching app. We do appreciate anybody who takes the time out to review the show, good or bad. If you do want to support us, please get over to patreon.com/the VHSStrikesBack. So, a massive thank you to Mike. Again, thank you so much, Mike, for coming on and supporting the podcast. Really appreciate it.
It's all good. I wanted to quickly say a little plug. So we mentioned Comics in Motion 1000 very briefly. Hopefully you guys put links in the description. If not, I'll just harass you and make you put them in there. The three of us, as well as Max Byrne and Tony Farina, who I know are loyal patrons and listeners of this show as well, we did the 1000th episode of the 6-year anniversary of Comics in Motion, which is one of the big podcasts that kicked off your guys' podcasting careers. It's how we all got connected as well. Had an absolute blast. 2 hours. If you like VHS Strikes Back, listen to Comics in Motion 1000. Never have to have heard an episode of Comics in Motion before, but it's absolute delight to be able to have you guys on there and just chat for like 2 hours. It was amazing. But also, Dave and I, we've got podcasts coming out of our ears. So, you know, we've done collaborations on Mandatory Music and CD on the Comics Emotion feed. Also, yep. We're doing the Clone Wars conversations on Genuine Chit Chat and on Comics Emotion as well, where we're going through the series of the animated series of the Clone Wars. And we've also done that from Rebels Review, the prequel films as well, Star Wars. And also, Chris and I are going to be recording an episode on my podcast, Genuine Chit Chat, as well, about Vegas and stuff, because I'm going to Vegas for the first time for my wedding in August. So if you follow me at Genuine and chit chat on any of the social media places, or you can catch me on the Comics Emotion feed. I've done plenty of podcasts with both Chris and Dave, and you go back to the back catalogue, we even did a whole episode about the podcast graveyard of all the podcasts you may not have heard before VHS Strikes Back, the CD Reality Cast, and Comics Emotion, because there were several before that and since, like Wrestling Gold, that have kind of disappeared into obscurity. So if you want to hear more of the history of Chris and Dave without quite as many wanking anecdotes, check out some of the episodes that they've been on of Genuine Chit Chat and a lot of the collaborations we've done on Comics Emotion. But thank you so much for having me on. It's a delight to support you on Patreon, to listen to VHS, and to be at a podcast with you two lovely chaps. So thank you so much, and thank you to anyone listening who checks out any of the stuff that I've done outside of this podcast.
That was amazing. Mike, you did all your own PR. I love that. Thank you so much, Mike. And that was lovely. And there is less wanking stories. You're right. So what a big thank you to our Patreon. So again, thank you, Mike. We've got Lee, Helen, Dylan, Stephen, Trent, Dan, Justin, Susan, Timothy, Matt, Heath, Ken, Lucky Lulu Green, Herb Jacks, Math Blake, John Hammond, and Mr. Tony Farina. So thank you so much, guys. And as always, we're at the end of the show. Mike, thank you so much for coming on, mate. We'll need to do this again. It was such good fun. But Dave, what are you going to take us out with today?
Well, rarely, Chris. I am actually prepared for this one. So strap yourself in and listen to this.
Choose life. Choose a podcast. Choose the VHS Strikes Back, where nostalgia reigns and VHS tapes are sacred scrolls of our cinematic pilgrimage. Choose to relive the neon-soaked lights and grunge-filled days. Choose the crackling sound of rewinding, the anticipation of the tracking button, the worn-out VHS sleeves that tell tales of countless late-night binges. Choose revisiting the classics that shaped a generation, the blockbusters that roared, the indie gems that whispered, and the cult favourites that became our secret society's password. Choose the era of mixtapes, scrunchies, and the dial-up internet, where the world was painted in shades of blockbusters, glue and gold. Choose the movies that defined our youth, the ones that made you laugh, cry, and question the very fabric of reality. Choose John Hughes's teenage angst, Spielberg's extraterrestrial encounters, and Tarantino's non-linear narratives. Choose the music that scored your rebellious adventures, the fashion that made you cringe and then secretly miss. Choose the thrill of the video store hunt, where the aisles were your treasure map and the VHS covers where the X marked the spot. Choose the click-clack symphony of the tape being inserted into the video player, the slight static hum as the movie began, and the magnetic dance between the heads as the story unfolded. Choose discussing these cinematic relics with fellow time travelers on the VHS Strikes Back. Choose the banter, the laughter, the heated debates over the best coming-of-age film or ultimate action hero. Choose being transported back to a time when movies weren't just stories, they were chapters of our lives, etched into the magnetic tape of our memories. So why the VHS Strikes Back? Why not? Choose it because, in this digital age, there's magic in the analogue. In the flickering images on a tube TV, in the joy of ejecting a tape and seeing it spin back to the beginning. Choose the podcast that brings the video era roaring back to life, frame by frame, rewind by rewind. Choose the VHS Strikes Back. Choose nostalgia. Choose movies. Choose life.
Well, there you go, Chris. A live take, of course. So thank you very much, sir. Thanks to Mike. Thanks to yourself. Thanks to all our listeners. Thanks to all our supporters. And we'll speak to you next time.
Bye.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we gonna do now?
What are we gonna do?
Maybe we could build a fire, sing a couple of songs, huh? Why don't we try that?
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
I'll be back.
That's a lot.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
Wax on, wax off.
One ring the bell.
All right.
Ding, ding.
Bust you up.
so bad. Ain't so bad. Ain't so bad. Ain't so bad. You must be crazy or something.
I'm crazy.
You're just a stupid fool.
Yeah, maybe you're stupid.
You're crazy.
I ain't breathing heavy.
He's a fool. He's stupid.
I've seen you in 6 months.